wonderful Buddhist monk is in the city this week. His name is Ajahn Amaro. He's actually a friend of Noah's, and actually he's a very, very influential monk. He's about 50 years old, I think. He's been a monk for around 30 years. He's now one of the most venerated teachers in the Theravadan tradition. And it's very rare to get a chance to hear monks. There's many monasteries, or at least quite a few in California, but in New York we don't really get to hear them as often as it would be, as I wish we could. Whenever a monk in my tradition comes through, I always go and sit with them. It's important to it's really important to actually sit with somebody who's pursued the path, really pushed it, is, you know, to the end or close to the end. Think of yourselves as, for a moment, to use a terrible analogy, but art students. That would make me like some average, like, art teacher. You know, some guy maybe had a couple of exhibitions, but like right now, you know, a great artist is in town, so you can get that opportunity to really be with and see for yourself what happens when you really put as much effort into the path as monks do. I heard a story about the monk that's in town, Ajahn Amaro. I don't know if it's true, I'm going to ask him. But I heard that he spent, there's a practice that Thai forest monks do where they train themselves to actually sleep sitting in their meditation posture. And apparently he spent 1 year just sleeping sitting upright. Why anybody would do that, I'm not clear. I don't know if I'd be able to walk after I did that for one night, but apparently he's... I've read a couple of his books, and they're amazing. He's very, very funny. His talks are online if you want to hear for yourself tonight, if you want to shop online before you commit. You can just type in Ajahn Amaro, A-M-A-R-O, and there's a lot of his talks, and he's a very funny guy. He's got a very wicked sense of humor. So if you want to check him out before going tomorrow, on Thursday, 7 o'clock, it will be a New York Insight. And no, I make no money promoting it. I just think it's a great idea to get the opportunity to hear monks. And if you're nervous about going to a different center, I will be there. I will hold your hand. Most of you probably don't want me to hold your hand, but I'm going to do it anyway. It will be very embarrassing for you. It will be embarrassing for me. But we'll be there holding hands. No, we won't. All right. Clearly the weather has gotten to me. Okay. So, yeah. So what is the difference between these wonderful monks and us? The Buddha actually taught two paths. He taught what's known as the mundane, or the path that most of the time those of us who have jobs and households and relationships lead. And that's called the mundane path. And then he taught what's also known as the transcendent path, which is the path for those who have renunciated living in, you know, households like we do, paying the rent, being in relationships, and have become monks. Now, that's not to say that lay practitioners like myself or you can't practice huge parts of the transcendent path. In fact, most of us do. I teach a lot of different techniques and suttas from the transcendent part of the teachings. And monks themselves practice and have to be reminded by their the ajahns that generally run the monastery, the teachers generally teach the other monks, and keep them in line. The Buddha wrote a long book, the Vinaya, which is just sets of regulations for monks to keep them in line. And there are 214 pretty basic rules. And when you read them, if you ever want to read them, it's sort of astonishing what the Buddha had to point out. I mean, there are rules against sleeping with monkeys. So... yeah, there's another reason we can't be monks. there's a lot of, when you read them, a lot of pretty funny rules. Clearly at the time when the Buddha lived, there are a lot of the theatrical and dances were part of these sacrifices where they would the Brahmins would sacrifice animals. And the Buddha was appalled by this. And so there are some rules that monks follow that are pretty archaic, you know, the ones against dancing and seeking out theatrical performances, hanging out late at night. But a lot of them make sense. So anyway, yeah, there are two paths, the mundane and the transcendent, and monks remind themselves and follow the rules of the mundane and listen to the suttas of the mundane, and lay practitioners can become enlightened and can practice the transcendent path. So what's the difference? The basic difference between the mundane and the transcendent, or the day-to-day and the enlightened, is that the Buddha viewed our happiness and our suffering as being the result of the things we do and the things we think. It's not something that's imposed on us. Sure, we can have some suffering and some great hardships imposed on us by others, but the bulk of our stress and suffering, the Buddha taught, is actually what he said, the second and third arrows we shoot into ourselves after something unfortunate happens. And sometimes we don't even need something unfortunate to happen. We just start shooting arrows into ourselves. What are these arrows? They're thoughts like, why me? Why do I have to suffer? Why do I have to be the one that grows old? Why do I have to be the one that doesn't get what he or she wants? Why don't I get everything that I want? Why doesn't everybody love me? Why does somebody say something mean to me? Why isn't life totally easy for me? Etc. We have all these thoughts about how life should be different. And we slam ourselves over the head. And when somebody says something unskillful to us, we repeat the unskillful thing that they said over and over and over in our head, arguing with them as if that actually does anything to them, and all it actually does, of course, is cause ourselves stress and suffering. So the Buddha saw all this suffering, and he taught a path where we would, over time, take actions and think thoughts that would create less stress and suffering, and would create more inner peace, calm and tranquility and happiness. So it's not about any gods. It's not about accumulating wealth. It's not about appeasing other people. And at the end of the day, it's about authoring the thoughts and the actions, creating the right thoughts and actions that will create long-term peace and happiness. Now, lay practitioners constantly throughout our meditations and throughout our days have to intervene and be what's known as mindfully sati, aware of what's going on in our minds and what we're doing, what our intentions are. And we try to refine over time our unskillful actions, like getting caught up in material envy, worrying constantly about what other people think about us or what's going to happen to me in the future, or how do I compare with other people, or how do I get over, or all these kinds of thoughts and actions that create a sense of, in the long term, a sense of feeling less than and feeling low self-esteem and feeling like we have to cheat or that we're not taken care of. These are all the things that those thoughts give birth to. So we have to monitor these thoughts and actions, and over time we practice training ourselves to, even though we want to run away or we want to just get caught up in self-centeredness all the time, we want to just get caught up in the sense of how can I get more, you know, we get caught up in our cravings. The Buddha has us practice cultivating actions that don't come naturally, like reflecting on all the things we've done skillfully, being generous, being compassionate with ourselves and others, having balance instead of getting involved with everybody or trying to make everybody love us, having a sense of wisdom as to how much good we can actually do, and to create boundaries so that we don't try to fix everything, especially things that can't be fixed. And especially the Buddha wanted us to cultivate inner peace so that we didn't constantly look for our happiness from the people around us. We didn't try to get people to give us our security, our sense of purpose, our sense of worthwhile, that we actually can give those sense to ourselves. When we constantly try to get those feelings of purpose and okayness and self-esteem from other people, we eventually wind up trying to control them, and then real problems start. So the more we can cultivate a sense of self-esteem and peace from within, the less we'll take from other people, the less we'll try to control from other people, and the easier it is to be and get along with other people. The more compassionate we are with other people, the more compassionate we'll be with ourselves. The mind is not something that can simply turn on and off judgmentalism. If you're judgmental with other people, you will turn that judgment onto yourself. If you're hypercritical with yourself, you'll turn that on other people. So the Buddha had us be constantly aware of what our attitudes and our thoughts and our actions are. But as lay practitioners, because we're so constantly involved in jobs and making a living and dealing with unskillful people and caught up in the world, we rarely get to that place where we can let go of monitoring ourselves, of putting the effort in, and just truly be in a place where we have become so calm and so skillful that eventually we don't have to be constantly monitoring ourselves, constantly checking what our intentions are, and making sure that we've not fallen back again and again into worrying about what's going to happen to me in the future, or obsessing with what other people think about me, etc., etc., etc. Most of us, because we're so engaged in the dramas of our lives and so, you know, caught up in craving and stuff like that, craving things in the world, we never get to a place of where we can just purely let go entirely and be in a truly calm, transcendently relaxed state. And that's where the transcendent path comes in. Really, the transcendent path is leads monks especially, but also lay practitioners who are really extremely diligent over time. Thoughts and actions and meditation become so skillful that they eventually don't have to take all this intervention, you know, this constant self-monitoring. They can eventually just come to a complete stop, a complete falling into their experience without having to make sure that they haven't fallen into bad habits that cause stress. So it takes a lot of work. There's this rumor that the Buddha said that all desire causes stress and suffering, and that's not what the Buddha taught. The Buddha said when we crave something out there to make us feel good in here for the long term, that's when the problems start. When we crave money or crave popularity and Facebook and crave, you know, a positive word from our boss, when we crave attention from a cute girl or a cute guy, when we crave these things to make us, when we crave a drink, when we crave crack, when we crave food, when we crave
monkeys.
Comedians, I can't remember what they call that, where you start a joke at the beginning of a routine and then you bring it back later on. There's a word for that. Reprise, what's it? What?
Recall?
A recall. Yeah, that's what we just did. We gotta bring it. We gotta keep doing that. Somebody throw in monkey later on. Later on. Okay. So we generally it's the problem is not desire. The problem is that we desire the wrong things. When a lay practitioner on the mundane path desires things, there's going to be three possible results. The first is short-term happiness, because that's what happens when you get what you're craving. You know, you want like an iPad. You wait, and then you order it, and then it comes, and then you feel really good. You got the iPad, and then 2 weeks later, you're like, what the fuck am I supposed to be doing with this thing? But for 2 weeks, it felt really good. Or you're feeling bummed out by work. Your boss says something you don't like, so you grab your credit card that still hasn't been maxed out, and you go directly to, Barney's or wherever, and you spend more than you should on something, and for about half an hour, the look of esteem in the salesperson's eye as you buy something that no human being can afford makes you feel a sense of self-esteem. And then, of course, it passes. I don't actually do this. I'm a cheapskate when it comes to clothes. I am everything I buy is used. But I do have an iPad, so there. We feel a sense of something missing, it can be a sense of purposelessness, a sense of incompletion, a sense of existential ennui, and because I needed to throw a bad French accent in there for no reason, just to make this sound like a real dorm. We feel this sense there's something missing, something wrong, and we seek something outside of ourselves to fill it, and it does for a while because we're distracted when we get the thing, whatever it is we've been trying to get, the person, the relationship, the thing. We're distracted from that inner feeling of there's something missing, and then eventually we become bored with that thing we've gotten, the iPad, and then we're back to the fact that we feel, what's the whole point? Why am I here? You know, a sense of being alone, a sense of emptiness, whatever it has you. So those are generally the two things that will happen. First, there'll be a sense of happiness, and then if we don't get it or when it goes away, then there's a sense of disappointment that comes from desiring the wrong thing. Happiness, getting it, disappointment, either we don't get it or it goes away. So the third possibility is what the Buddha called householder or lay person's or mundane equanimity. And that is equanimity with that sense of when you get to a place where you're so, you just give up trying to find happiness out there, and there's a sense of okayness or uninvolvement with whatever happens. It's a sense of detachment, a sense of it's whatever I know, I'm not going to get it out there. You just are no longer clutching at certain things and pushing away other experiences. It's a sense of no longer getting involved, a sense of balance, a sense of okayness with whatever arises. You're not finding any absolute happiness in this equanimity, but you're not being pushed around anymore like a, you know, piece of paper in the wind being blown about, chasing wonderful kind words, running away from insults. You're not chasing after things that feel good and running away from things that feel bad. You're not chasing after a promotion or running away from the fear of what's going to happen if they fire me. You're just pleasantly, you're just abiding, and you're just, there's this sense that things are happening, and as Ajahn Chah said, you're taking the one seat, just watching, but you're not grasping. Now, in life, sometimes this state comes about skillfully through meditation. Sometimes it comes about unskillfully. People can have a real tragedy or a brush with death. They can lose somebody, or they can have a huge midlife crisis, a sense of disillusionment where they see the profound hollowness of what they do for a living or whatever. And then we get to a place of such shock that we're no longer involved with the world. And the Buddha clearly didn't say that was a skillful state, when we just become disillusioned and we don't care anymore. That's a state akin to just complete indifference. And the Buddha never taught that. The Buddha said that where we can be helpful, we should be. We should try to help out when we can, in other words. But also, he said that when things happen externally that are good, we should appreciate them, not simply just be totally indifferent. But he said we shouldn't grasp. So if you see like a beautiful sunset, which is not going to happen today, but if you see if something really nice happens, if you accomplish something in your work that, you know, people like or whatever, you experience it, you feel good, but you don't grasp onto it because you know it's going to change. You know, just as surely as you're going to get warm remarks at your job, eventually someone's going to criticize you, just as surely as you're going to meet somebody who's cute, you know, maybe the relationship will end or you're both grow old or whatever. You know, there's always, if you attach to things that pass, you'll wind up stressed out and suffering. But if you just appreciate them with a sense of knowing that they're all impermanent, then you can actually get quite a nice sense of appreciation from life and a sense of enjoyment. And there's wonderful feelings that can arise so long as we don't get attached, so long as we realize that these events outside are not going to be the thing that brings us lasting inner peace and a sense of real sense of purpose and a real sense of inner self-esteem. So it's not about that sense of just complete disillusionment and detachment. It's actually a sense of appreciating things that arise and pass, but not trying to keep them when they're passing, not trying to force them to arise when they're not arising. And there are certain things the Buddha said you just shouldn't get involved with, like crack, you know. You don't have the equanimity of, well, the crack was there, it arose, I grabbed it, I had it, it was wonderful, I didn't hold on to it, it lasted 20 minutes and then it was gone, I'm totally okay with, nah. The Buddha said that there's five things that we don't get involved with: killing, stealing, lying or speaking harmfully, causing harm through sex, and causing harm through intoxication. And basically any form of getting wasted is causing harm to yourself, if not other people. So that's the normal results of desire. But then the Buddha said that monks in the renunciate path, there's a skillful desire that they could have. They can actually desire to achieve inner peace through the Eightfold Path, through acting skillfully, through giving up all their, you know, attachments to the normal things that we are attached to. Monks do not have fixed abodes. They only have three robes. They have a bowl that's slightly larger than this. That's one of the few things that they own, is their bowl and their robes. And they live off of the charity of others. Monks do not carry money. And this uninvolvement, though, this lack of trying to get happiness from material things, refocuses them on not only being compassionate and leading lives where they help others. All monks lead very, very compassionate, involved lives, but they also spend a lot of the day cultivating lasting peace within. They meditate a fucking long time. So the three desire, results of the desires that a monk has to achieve lasting peace within can lead to three results. Just like a householder's desires for things outside to make him happy leads to happiness, disappointment, and equanimity, the monks can be happy when they achieve a goal, when they achieve a sense of great peace, when they have attained what's known as one of the jhana states of radical transcendent inner peace. Or they can be disappointed in the sense that they can not reach a goal that they wanted to reach. They might have a desire to put in a certain amount of meditation in each year, or they might want to develop some part of their practice and they might not meet it, and they'll have a sense of disappointment, but they won't beat themselves up about it. They'll just use that disappointment to spur themselves to be more generous or to be more appreciative or to be more helpful or to be more diligent in their development of wisdom. Finally, there is the renunciate equanimity, which is the highest state that you can get to. And that's when a monk has attained this state of radical inner peace, and he can let go and have no more need to do anything. He's there. He's arrived. He doesn't have to feel good or bad. He's just in that experience of having attained enlightenment. And that's the final transcendent path. The Buddha said that even the highest form of balance that we practice, you know, on the mundane path, most of us, the highest state that we attain, which is equanimity, is not as fruitful as the lowest state of the transcendent, which is disappointment. Because when we're in just pure equanimity, where we're not trying to get anything from the outside world, we're just appreciating it and watching things arise and pass, he still said we haven't yet found out that there is a source of true lasting inner peace and tranquility and happiness. And that's what the transcendent path is all about. It's about acknowledging that there's fun, wonderful things to watch in the world, but that there's this fundamental shift that all monks have, where they turn the efforts of all their endeavors to really working their spiritual path, where they really let go profoundly to a degree that most of us can't imagine to this quest that we have of accumulation and of getting from the world. And there's this real sense of letting go, and this sense of offering, and this sense of being truly at peace. So, very quickly, If you're interested in how do you make the jump to the higher state of equanimity and then into the transcendent path when we're so caught up in our day-to-day lives and all the dramas of our jobs and our relationships, the Buddha authored this chant that monks and lay practitioners say that is interesting. It sounds depressing at first, but I think it's a very helpful thing to remember, which is the five remembrances. I am of the nature to grow old. I am of the nature to become sick. I am of the nature to die. All that is dear to me eventually will pass. I am the owner of all of my actions. The first four are pretty fucking bleak. They basically are reminding ourselves, keep a sense of perspective, that all the stuff that we're chasing after in the world, they can be beautiful things, but they are all going to be impermanent, they're all conditional, we can't control them. We have no idea when someone we love will go away. We have no idea when we'll become bored of the things that we've spent so long to accumulate or to own or possess, but that always does happen. But the Buddha did balance it off with the fifth part, I am the owner of all of my thoughts and actions, which means I can feel profound peace or profound suffering as a result of what I do. That I still have something that can bring me a sense of lasting peace, which is if I act skillfully, if I appreciate the virtuous things I've done and the virtuous things that other people have done, if I cultivate forgiveness, if I cultivate balance and equanimity, if I cultivate wisdom, seeing which thoughts and actions are helpful, if I cultivate generosity and if I cultivate goodwill, all these thoughts and actions, I will wind up in a happier place, a more peaceful place. So there is something I can depend upon. There is something that will give me a purpose. There is something that can make me feel complete and whole and give my life a sense of vision. So I am completely burnt out from that talk. I thank you all for listening. If you can join me either tomorrow or Thursday, or he's giving also a day-long talk on Sunday. Noah is going to be here on Saturday at the Tibet House, so if you'd like to, you could actually do a whole bunch of Buddhism this week. So again, tomorrow and Thursday at nyimc.org, that's 28 West 27th Street, I'll be there. A bunch of us will be there to hear Ajahn Amaro. Saturday, Noah. Sunday, again, Ajahn Amaro at 28 West 27th Street. So thank you for listening.
What is Tibet House?
Tibet House is...